Welcome to Strong Tower Radio Today. The views and opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of Strong Tower Radio, West Central Michigan Media Ministries, or its employees.
Hello, folks, and welcome to Strong Tower Radio Today, and it's the Garden Guy Show. Good growing with the Garden Guy, Gary Heilig. Welcome, Gary.
Happy to be here, and spring is here.
All right, and also my co-host is Sue Majeure, joining us by phone from Kalamazoo. Welcome, Sue.
Thank you. I really am glad to spring in.
All right, there you go. Yeah, Sue is my sister, and we're going to get started with the April edition. Sue, would you lead us in a word of prayer?
Yes. Heavenly Father, thank you that spring is coming. New life, and it's representative of the new life that you can have for us if we will only accept it when you come again. We're looking forward to seeing our spring down here as it represents that. And all the loveliness that you created for us. Help us to continue learning about it so that we can keep it in front of us and know how important it is. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
Gary, you have something in a brown bag there. What are you hiding from us?
Well, I'm not going to show you just yet.
Okay.
I want you to have the quiz first and kind of set this up.
Oh, okay. Let's go with the quiz.
So the quiz kind of centers on citrus fruit. And the first question is, what are the three fruits from which all modern citrus come from?
All modern citrus. Mm-hmm. I'll just say oranges.
That's it? There's three.
I know. I give up.
Sue, any guesses?
Well, I'm thinking the orange things, probably. Everything comes out of China, so maybe mandarins. And I love mandarin orange. I love those little ones. Those are my favorite. So I'm going to vote for them, like Tom. And maybe some sort of grapefruity thing. And then maybe some sort of lemon thing.
Have you been doing any research? Well, anyway, the mandarin orange is one. And the second one is the pomelo, which if you see it in the grocery store, looks like a large grapefruit. And the last one is the citron.
Okay, I've heard of that.
Which, if you look at it, it looks sort of like a lemon. Although the citron, the juice inside of it, it's very dry. The flesh inside of it is very dry. But the pomelo is like a grapefruit. It's larger. It doesn't have the bitterness of a grapefruit. It's quite sweet and mild. So you might call it a mild grapefruit tasting. And, of course, everybody knows what mandarin oranges are. And so all modern citrus, lemons, limes, everything, come from crosses or hybrids of those three basic ones.
So why do we have grapefruit if this other thing seems so delightful?
Well, some of these things were crossed on purpose to see what they would get. And I thought about that and I said, you know, God knew what he was doing when he placed these plants. He knew man would create new things out of it by crossing and hybridization. And we have so many different citrus fruits now, and we're going to talk about some of those. That's one of the questions. And I think it's just one of the blessings that we have.
Very good.
And, of course,
well, some people like sour taste. I mean, look at the British. They really like their bitter orange marmalade and stuff.
That's right. There's bitter, there's sweet, and sour in citrus fruits. So that's what are they – I guess it's three out of five of the taste. And the next question is, what is the most popular citrus fruit in the world?
Well, I think it's got to be oranges because they make, you know, billions of gallons of the stuff.
Yeah, that's right. Oranges. Now, the next one is, what are the top five producers of citrus fruits?
Well, China's got to be on that list.
In the world. Yeah.
Yeah, China's always on there. It's got to be China.
That's number two.
Let's see. Well, they need to work.
There's got to be something in the Mediterranean.
Well, name someplace.
I'm going to say Italy for the sake of it because it hangs way down there.
Not in the top five.
Okay.
But you're in the right neighborhood. The EU is number three.
Okay.
Which would include Italy, Spain, places like that.
Because you got to have a warm climate, so maybe Central or South America where it's warm.
Brazil.
Brazil is number one. Yeah, Brazil's number one. We have two more to go.
Oh, my.
Four and five.
Some other place warm. Well, Africa crosses the equator, so maybe some of those countries.
Nope. Number four is Mexico.
Okay, that makes sense.
Number five is the United States.
Okay.
We're five?
We're number five.
I'm surprised.
Well, we don't have, you have California, and you have Texas, and then you have Florida, and that's about it.
Well, that's the next question.
Oh.
What are the four U.S. states that grow citrus commercially?
Well, there's three of them.
The other one's got to be some warm something.
Mm-hmm.
So, like New Mexico or Arizona.
It's Arizona. Yeah. Those are the four. California, Florida, Texas, and Arizona. What's the number one growing citrus trait in the U.S.?
That one takes a little thought. It's.
I think it's Florida.
And you would be right.
Okay.
Because California, I mean, some of it's probably too deserty, and they have a lot of other crops that they grow there that compete, you know?
Okay, these last two might be a little more difficult. Why is it illegal to take any citrus products into Texas and California?
There wasn't the medfly, the Mediterranean medfly.
I think it's bugs and diseases.
It is, and it's specifically, it is citrus greening, which is a bacterial disease carried by the Asian psyllid, which is like an aphid. So those are the reasons. You can't take anything from citrus into those states. Now, this one's going to really be tough.
Well, I just pause. Can I raise my hand here?
Sure. Go ahead.
Why is Florida excluded from that list?
Because citrus greening is already there, and it has wiped out a good portion of their citrus industry already.
Really?
Yeah, I think it's around 60, 70% or more. It's been devastating. And our church used to buy citrus, and we used to sell it when we were Pathfinder leaders.
Indian River
citrus, right. And that we just haven't seen that. So many growers are gone out. But they're working on it to see if they can solve that problem. But right now, it's a tough battle. Okay, the last one is, well, actually not the last one. Up to the 60,000 flowers that you find on a mature citrus tree, what percentage of flowers need to set fruit in order to have a full crop? This is a multiple choice question. 1%, 5%, 10%, or 15%?
I say 1%. I got to thinking about this.
Okay, what do you say, Tom?
Let's see. What citrus fruit is there's a lot of water in there. Water is heavy. And so if 1% of 60,000 is like 600... And that's an awful lot of fruit on a tree without breaking branches.
Mm-hmm. And some of the flowers fall off anyway, so I'm going to go with 1%.
That's very good deductive reasoning, Sue. It's absolutely correct. 5% would be a really, really, really heavy crop. But that's a lot of flowers on a tree. Okay, here's the next one. How many types of citrus can you name?
Ooh, this is going to be fun, Tom. This one's going to be fun. I'm going to say mandarin oranges, which are my favorite ones.
Okay, we've already talked about that one. Uh-huh. Keep going.
And there's tangelos and satsumas and ugly fruit and blood oranges and clementines. And there's limes, like key limes, and there's Persian limes, and there's kaffir limes, and there's lemons, like regular lemons. And there's Meyer lemons, and there's kumquats. Don't you love that word? Kumquats.
Mm-hmm.
And grapefruit, and what are those things called that look like a grapefruit, except they're really wrinkly and ugly? Ugly fruit or something like that?
Well, there is an ugly fruit, yeah.
And Buddha's fingers.
Buddha's fingers, Buddha's hand.
What about star fruit?
No, that's not a citrus. You've got most of them. You didn't mention the bergamot orange.
Oh,
and you didn't mention the Rangpur lime. And I should have looked up the proper pronunciation of this one, but it looks like Kalamandan. I think it's Kalamandan.
I don't think I've ever heard of that one.
Yeah, it's kind of small, and you said bitter orange, right? And then there's another one that mostly the Japanese use called a yuzu.
I have heard of that one.
Mm-hmm. Now, tangerines are a mandarin orange with some pomelo DNA in it. Blood oranges are a natural mutation of the orange, of the original oranges. And tangelo is a grapefruit times a mandarin. So these are all crosses that people have made. Some of them have been natural crosses. Others have been intentional crosses.
Why isn't the kumquats, because we had those, I haven't seen them in years, but when we were kids, they had them. And
you see them in Myers.
The thing about them is that the skins were sweet, but inside they were.
Yeah, they tend to be more sour inside. And in Japan, they eat the entire thing because the skin is sweet. And you can eat the skins of citrus. I used to have a pastor that ate an orange, and he ate it just like he'd eat an apple, skins and all. And
you know, it's usually the other way around. The skins are bitter and the inside sweet, but kumquats are the other way.
And there's Chinese dish called orange chicken. We used to get orange tofu, and they actually stir fry peels into that. And I love it. So I've eaten citrus peels and like it quite a bit. Also, the bitter orange is a cross between the mandarin orange and the pomelo. That has a wrinkled appearance, too. The grapefruit is believed to have been an accidental hybridization of the common orange and the pomelo. And the ugly fruit, which I tried it once, it's absolutely delicious. It's a crossing between the orange, the tangerine, and the grapefruit. And the calamondin is a hybrid of kumquat and mandarin orange. The lemon that we have today is a cross between a male citron and a female sour orange. And there were some other references that had a little bit different thing on that. But so those are some examples. Now, here's something I want to show you, Tom.
Okay.
So nobody can see it at home, of course.
You know,
but
they're yellow. You have two of them.
These are lemons.
Yes.
Eureka lemons.
Okay.
Tell me which one was grown in Michigan.
Okay.
Oh.
I'm reaching over to say these wouldn't happen to have been grown in your greenhouse, would they?
One of them was grown on my tree, and one of them I bought at the local grocery store.
Wow, let's see. Wait a minute. One's a little more pointy than the other. There's no way of... I mean, they're quite similar. They're very, very similar.
Mm-hmm.
They're a good size lemon. They fit in the palm of my hand, at least, quite fully. And they look very, very good.
Well, as Joe Cruz used to say, make a decision.
Make a decision, okay. One has the more of a pointed protrusion on the end, and the other one is not more nubbed over. I will say this one, this one,
okay.
Whatever that means.
Okay. No, it's the other one.
It's the other one.
That one was grown. You can't tell the difference.
No, you can't tell the difference. Actually, yours is more round, and it's perfect. It just really looks nice.
Yeah, you can grow those in Michigan. So right now, my lemon tree is just loaded with blossoms, and I've been hand-pollinating it with a Q-tip, and it's now loaded with lemons. This will be the first year. Usually, you have to wait a good 3 years before you get much of a crop. And I bought the largest lemon tree I could buy, and it's now producing lemons.
Awesome.
Now, how long does it take from flowering to where you get to pick?
That depends also. Normally, in ideal conditions, it's about 4 to 6 months. But some references said up to 9 months. But if you have less than ideal conditions, which I would say that's the case in Michigan, I would say up to a year. And once they're ready, which this one... I even picked up the wrong one. This one was ready. It can be left on the tree for a few weeks and won't lose any quality. If it was ripening at the right time of the year, it'll actually sweeten up as it stays on the tree. But I wanted to mention a couple of things that I was picking up as I was trying to grow this. These are trees growing in pots right now. I also have a tangelo tree and some avocados and some other things.
You've been growing these in the past, correct, if mm-hmm. I heard correctly?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, many people would be quite amazed that you're growing this. I guess once in a while you see them into some greenhouse in a garden you go to and so on and so forth. But this is quite an accomplishment.
Yeah, it's a little bit of work, but one of the things I found out is that lemon trees need a cool period during the winter in order for them to set their flowers. And so in my basement, it's ideal for that. It's an unheated garage. I get some heat going in there, just enough to keep them from being damaged. So we'll continue it in our next segment here.
Well, folks, you're listening to Good Growing with the Garden Guy, better known as The Garden Show. And Gary Heilig and Sue and Tom Bajur will be back after this break.
Strong Tower Radio publishes a monthly newsletter about the ministry's progress and listeners' response. Get the free subscription just by calling 231-468-2087. Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is proclaimed.
Hello, you're listening to Strong Tower Radio today with the April Garden Guy program with Sue and Tom Bajur and Gary Heilig. Gary, tell us a little bit more about your lemon experience.
Well, first of all, I have them under lights in the basement. They're in my underground garage, which is a little cooler, which is one of the requirements for them to set flowers during the winter months. And I have them under lights. A minimum of 8 to 12 hours are required, but I'm running them at about 16 right now. And when I pollinate the flowers, they're receptive as long as the stigma is sticky on the tip. So I take a Q-tip and I just simply brush the pollen off of the stamens onto the stigma, and I go from flower to flower, and I have fruit set on quite a few of the flowers so far.
Is it for each individual one, or can you do it from one and do it for a couple of them?
Well, I have to do that for each individual flower, and of course, this pollen left on the Q-tip, and it just goes from flower to flower. So it's very easy to pollinate. Now, when I move them outside, if it's still blooming, the bees will take care of that for me. But it's producing fruit now, and it'll take a minimum of 4 to 6 months for them to ripen, but since we have less than ideal conditions, it's going to be more like up to a year. So I started getting flowers in December and start pollinating them then. So as we get into cool weather again, when the lemons should start to harvest or ripen, then the timing will be about right. And if you don't have cooler weather in the fall, then the lemons will remain green. Mm. And that's true for a lot of citrus. It needs to cool down for them to finish and get that final color.
So it starts and cooled for the...
The flowers, yeah.
And then it goes warm, and then it finishes off and cool.
It finishes off and cool again. That's why we get our first oranges in November from Florida, and then we just move on through the different types of citrus fruit up until about March here in Michigan. We get stuff from California also. So,
how do you tell when they're ripe?
They get their color, and then they can sit on the tree for a few weeks. So, and also by their size. And if you're not sure, you can always cut one off and check it, because that's what a grower would do. Just like when I have my apple orchard and I want to know if they're ready, one of the things I can do is check the sugar content. And I have a refractometer that will tell me what the sugar content is, and I can check that on a chart for lemons, and that'll also tell me when they're ready to harvest. So anyway, there are a number of different ways, and maybe we'll talk about that some other time. But if you're going to grow citrus, it needs to be a fast-draining soil, like you can get a citrus and cactus soil from the garden center. They need to be fertilized with twice as much nitrogen as they do phosphorus, potassium, so you might get something like a 12-6-6 or something similar to fertilize them with. And or you can use a liquid fertilizer every week, according to label directions. And also, when you're watering the trees, citrus like a good watering, and then let the surface dry out down about an inch before you water it again, especially when you're in containers. Outside, it's a little different, but still, since it's in a container, you'll need to watch the water very closely during the summer months. And you might find that you'll water in August maybe twice a day, depending on how warm it is and how windy it is. And there's some other things that you need to consider in terms of pests. Like, I get scale, and I just use an insecticidal soap to deal with that. If you get a micronutrient deficiency, you can make up a weak solution of a liquid fertilizer and spray it on the leaves, and that'll usually solve that problem.
Sounds good. Sounds good. What about zinc there and its benefits?
Well, as we've discussed in previous months, we've always been talking about some nutrient that plants require, And this month we're going to talk about zinc. And I thought about zinc as opposed to some of the others because when you start to catch a cold, you might want to go reach for one of those lozenges like Cold-EZ. It has zinc in it, and it has antiviral properties. And but in a plant, it's required for growth and development. And it's very important in the development of enzymes. And the enzymes are, or the enzymes are responsible for lots of metabolic processes that go on in the plant, like photosynthesis and respiration and things of that sort.
The really basic, important things.
Right. Without them, the plant's just not going to function well. And when you're deficient in zinc, then you start to see a slowdown of growth, slowdown of various types of development. It doesn't produce as many sugars, which, of course, it's like if you don't eat, how well are you going to do? So very important. Now, it is a micronutrient, which means it needs very small amounts. So if you did a leaf sample and you took it into, say, Michigan State University or some other land-grant university, and you wanted to know if you had a zinc problem, they would look at it and determine how much zinc is in the plant by chemical analysis. And most plants require anywhere from 20 to 250 parts per million. That's a large range, but it depends on what plant you're growing. And so if you did a zinc test, which you can do when you're doing soil tests, you can find out what's in the ground, but you could also do leaf analysis to find out what's getting into the plants. But usually when the leaves start to look a little strange, like they get light green with yellow veins or yellowish leaves with green veins, they're different types of micronutrient deficiencies. They're sometimes kind of similar. So you might need an expert to tell you which one it is. But you're more likely to have these problems if your pH is really out of whack in the soil, or if you're on certain types of soils, like very sandy soils, or if your soil test comes back and the levels of phosphorus in your soil are very high. That can put your zinc out of whack, because many of these nutrients can become a problem when other nutrients are too high in the soil. So what do we do? And what plants respond well if you apply zinc to them? Apples specifically, tomatoes, sweet corn, snap beans, and onions will respond well if your zinc levels are low. And the best sources of zinc would be either what we call chelated zinc, which means it's in a form that can easily be absorbed through the leaf, like a liquid fertilizer, or to the soil, we would put down zinc sulfate. Now, another thing that you can do if you have animal manures, like cow and sheep and those types of things, they will have zinc in them because humans and animals need zinc too. So they don't use all of it, so they excrete some of it. And also compost, because when you break down organic matter, that will recycle the zinc into the soil. So those are two things you can add to that won't cost you much money. Now, some might say, can you get too much zinc? Yes, you can, and it will reduce growth. It can affect photosynthesis and respiratory rate and those types of things. Most likely, most people won't overdo it, but I just want you to know, some people have this attitude, if I put on a little bit, it's good. If I put on a lot, it's even better. But remember, it's a micronutrient. So if I was a farmer and I was applying zinc to acres, you might need no more than 2 pounds over an entire acre. Mm. And an acre is 43,560 square feet. So it would be not too difficult for you to put on too much.
Very good.
Kind of like mulch, Tom?
Yeah.
And in some cases, when you run a soil test, like if you were a commercial grower and you're growing certain crops, they would recommend you do a zinc test because that plant responds well to zinc and it's a little bit more sensitive to other plants than other plants. Now, whether or not you should do it in a home situation, if the plants are growing in a nice dark green, there's no need to do it.
Sounds good. What should we talk about next?
Well, we're in April. And we actually can start to think about getting some things done outside. You can start to plant your cool season crops like onions and beets, lettuce. Of course, they may need to be protected, especially young seedlings, because they can still get some fairly cold weather. Spinach, carrots, radishes. All these things can be put in. Now, I'd hold off on potatoes because they don't like... Usually, you wait till the last frost in the spring. You're gambling if you put them in earlier, but you know, hey, put in a couple of rows and try it. But I would think more toward the mid to late April time period.
Pansies?
Oh, yeah, you can put pansies in. There are lots of flowers you can put in, too, but I'm thinking of stuff we can eat.
Oh, sorry, I was thinking about things that resist frost.
Oh, yeah, yeah, you could. Violas also. When the soil temperatures get up around 65 to 85, that's when you want to put potatoes in the ground. But again, when you want to know about when is the best time to put certain things in the ground in terms of seeds, I would get one of those seed temperature charts that would tell you, and a soil thermometer, so you can monitor the soils, and that will get you off to a really good start. This is also a good time to prune ornamental trees. And although I would avoid oaks at that time because of oak wilt, and you should be finishing up on your fruit trees in April, but the last ones you want to do, of course, are the stone fruits like the cherries and apricots and the peaches and plums and those types of things. And in terms of planting, you can plant everything. You can put bulbs in, you can put your trees in. If you're on heavier soils, then if we have a lot of rain, the holes might fill up with water and you may want to wait a little bit. But if you're on a lighter textured soil and it drains well, you can get right out there and get these things planted. Trees, shrubs, bulbs, fruits, strawberries, raspberries, grapes, blueberries, all of these things can be put in the ground during April if the weather permits. Another thing that you can do is if you have a lighter textured soil, this won't apply probably to clay textured soils, you may actually be able to get out there and turn under any crop residuals that you didn't clean up last year, or if you had a cover crop and you wanted to till it in, you can get that done in April. Or if you want to spread manure and compost and till those things in, April's a good time to do that.
Give the definition of heavy soils.
Soils are made of three different particles in the mineral portion of the soil. One is clay, one is sand, and one is silt. And a clay soil has a higher percentage of the clay particles in it. It may have a lower percentage of organic matter. Those tend to dry out more slowly because the particles are so small that water tends to stand on top of the soil longer. And when it does move into the soil profile, it moves more slowly. Whereas sand, on the north end of my property, it's very sandy soil. Water never stands there. It always trickles down. And as you go to the southern part of my property, you'll see some areas where water will stand, where you have a little higher clay content. So it takes longer for those soils to dry off. It takes longer for them to warm up. And if I was getting ready to till, for instance, one of the things I do is I'll go grab a handful of soil and squeeze it. And if it crumbles easily, then it's dry enough to till. If it stays in a ball and it's pretty tight, or you have lots of water in that ball, then you might want to wait a little bit longer, especially if you have a clay soil.
That's good advice there. The clay, the hand clay test or the clump test.
Yeah, as you get experience, you'll learn your soil, or you'll even learn the type of soil that you have in different parts of your yard, if you have a fairly large yard like I do, and you handle things a little differently. Like I can work the north soils sooner than I can work the southern soils in my yard, just because there's a difference in the quality of the soil.
Well, very good. Let's take a break right now and come back and continue with the April Garden Guy.
Hello, friends. This is Doug Batchelor with Amazing Facts, and thank you for listening to Bible Answers Live on Strong Tower Radio. To find out our broadcast times, simply go to strongtowerradio.org.
Hello, we're back with Good Growing with the Garden Guy, Tom and Sue Majeure with Gary Heilig, and we left off talking about pruning. What else should we be paying attention to?
Well, one of the things is with ornamentals is we just had an ice storm not too long ago, and I'm still trying to clean up, and I have a white pine just outside my bedroom window, which is on the south side of our house. And I've got all kinds of branches to clean up. So that's the time to get some of these things cleaned up. And when we are pruning ornamentals, we have different objectives than we do when we're pruning a fruit-producing tree.
Tell us about that. Yeah.
Well, one of the things that we're interested in is it might be a flowering tree. And so many of the flowering trees will put their flower buds out in the previous August. So if you prune in the spring, you're going to remove flowers. You have to decide if you want to do that or not. But if you haven't pruned in a number of years, it might be worth trimming off some flowers in order to get the tree back into control. We also we want to prune so that the tree will look nice. Whereas commercially, when we're pruning fruit trees, we want them to be productive. They don't necessarily have to be beautiful. Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of farmers will still prune so that their trees will look nice, especially if it's not a really large orchard, because you can prune trees so that they look beautiful. And then there are examples where when I used to go out and visit commercial orchards, they would use these machines that would just whack away like they were trimming a shrub. And they didn't look all that beautiful, but they were productive.
Okay.
So those are some of the things you have to think about. I have a mere maple in my front yard, and it has water sprouts that I didn't take out. Now they're branches that are about 3 inches across growing straight up. And that really ruined the overall look of the tree. But I can still trim those out and make that tree look nicer. Maybe I'll do that and do a YouTube video on it. When you're thinking about pruning your shrubs, you need to think of the same thing, because anything that's blooming before about the beginning of June to about mid-June, those flower buds are in place, like lilac is an example of that. Whereas others, they will put their flowers on the wood that grew last year, or I should say it might be current season's wood. And so if you prune in the late winter, early spring, you're not going to affect the flowers because they haven't come onto the wood yet. It'll come on the new growth. Whereas the lilacs, it's on one-year-old growth from the previous year. So you need to think about that. If something blooms after mid-June, then it's okay to prune it in the spring. You're not going to lose any flowers. And then, of course, we want to take out any diseased material or dead material, any suckers that are growing around the base. You also want to think about branches that are crossing that make the plant look untidy. If you have plants that are, they have a form where they're weeping, sometimes the weeping forms will tend to send out branches growing straight up, or they'll grow suckers lower on the plant where you don't want any kind of branches, and all those things have to be trimmed off this time of year also. Now with the fruit trees, as we said, we're trying to do things so that they're productive. And I have a number of videos on my YouTube channel of different types of trees and how to prune them. You might want to go back and look at that. But one of the videos I want to make this year is we traditionally tell people that you don't need to treat a pruning wound in most cases. And in the past, I've talked about if it's a stone fruit like a peach or cherry, if it's an inch or more in size, or I should say the size of a quarter, then you should treat it with a wound sealer. And that's to keep insects and diseases out. But one of the videos I want to make is I'm going to prune some apples, and on one, I'm going to treat it with a wound sealer, even though I don't need to. And the other one, I'm not. Because many times where you make a cut, that's where you get a lot of growth, right around that cut. Mm-hmm. And I want to see if the pruning wound sealer will decrease that. So stay tuned. I'll be doing that. I suspect it will. And if it does, that would be an advantage to using a pruning wound sealer so that you don't have all these suckers growing all over the place.
Oh, yeah.
Especially when you're making bigger cuts, that's when you really start to see those.
What about our lawns? Sometimes we forget the lawns. We are so focused on production and food. Let's come back to lawns. What do we do this time of year?
Well, April is when the lawns just begin to grow. And one of the things I warn people about is if you've had grub problems from the previous year that you didn't treat, as soon as the grass starts to grow, those grubs will start feeding again before they turn into beetles, which they'll start to turn into beetles in May and June. And then they'll lay eggs again, and then those eggs will hatch in July. So if you find that you are getting grub feeding, and one of the ways to tell if you're getting grub feeding is lots of birds digging around in your lawn, or raccoons and skunks digging holes and peeling up the soil, or areas dying, and you go and grab the grass and you can pull it up because there aren't very many roots, if none at all. And so if you're going to be reseeding those areas, if you still have grubs there, they'll eat the seed.
Mm, really?
And if your lawn is not well cared for, they can do quite a bit of damage. So you should at least check if you've had problems in the past. And if you have, then there's a product called Dilox and a 7-granular that you can put down that will kill them. Organically, at that stage, you're going to have difficulty controlling them. If you want to use organic materials, you have to use it in August, like various grub control things like I think nematodes are an example. Predatory nematodes can be put down during that time when the eggs are hatching, and they'll go after them. And there are a few other products, but you don't have very many options compared to Dilox and 7. Some people would. Now, if you don't want to spray at all, then what you want to do is have a more aggressive fertilization program, more aggressive watering program. And by getting that grass growing, it can handle a lot more damage if it's growing well than it would be if it's a stressed lawn. Also, this time of year, we start to get the crabgrass germinating. And when the forsythias are in full bloom, that yellow shrub that has the flowers without the leaves, that's a time that you want to put something down to prevent the crabgrass from growing. And also when the soil temperatures are getting up to about 50 degrees, that's when the seeds are going to start to germinate. And again, if you have a nice thick lawn, you will have a lot less crabgrass because it's an opportunistic weed. It looks for open spaces. If you have a nice thick lawn, you're not going to have a lot of crabgrass. And you can also help that by mowing high, because lawns that are mowed short, and a lot of people still mow their lawn short in the winter because that's what they used to do, which we don't recommend that anymore. And by mowing it short, it allows more sunlight to the surface, which increases germination of weed seeds. Mm. So keep it longer. And if you don't want to use the traditional chemicals that they have, there's a corn gluten meal that works pretty well. It comes under a number of names, but it can be put down as a pre-emergence, just like some of the other chemicals that will decrease significantly the crabgrass if you get it down before they're germinating.
Well, very good. What about fertilizing of your lawn?
Well, fertilization, normally what we try to suggest people do, because during that time of the year, most of the growth is by the roots. There's certain times of the year when the roots are growing, certain times of the year where you're getting more top growth. So during the cooler parts of the year, in the beginning, you get a lot of root growth. So you don't want to give your lawn a lot of high nitrogen fertilizer at that time. If you want to give it some, you might want to go with a half rate. Especially if you're trying to recover a lawn or you're doing some overseeding because your lawn is thin, then it's okay to put some fertilizer down, but I'd use what we call a half rate. And the way we figure that is when a full rate of fertilizer would be 1 actual pound of nitrogen per 1,000 square feet. So if you were using, I'll just use urea as an example, you're going to use about 2 pounds per 1,000 square feet in order to deliver that 1 pound, because urea is 46% nitrogen.
Okay.
So you need 2 pounds in order to get 1 actual pound of N. And it varies depending on what the analysis of your fertilizer is. So if you were using like a 10-10-10 fertilizer, which has equal amounts of nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium in it, normally we wouldn't use anything like that unless a soil test said you need phosphorus and potassium or you were starting a new lawn. But let's say that's what you were doing. You're going to need 10 times as amount in order to get that 1 actual pound of nitrogen because it's only 10% nitrogen in that bag.
That's okay? True.
So remember, a full rate would be 10 pounds. So you would use half of that in April if you were going to fertilize with a half rate, and if it was urea, you'd only use 1 pound per 1,000 square feet, which is considered a half rate. So if you have problems with the math, you can call your local extension office and they can help you with that.
Very good. If you have ants invading your house, what do you do?
Well, a lot of times I come up with these subjects because
they happen to you.
They're happening to me. And right now I have a carpenter ant Lollapalooza parade.
That's not good.
Every day I wake up and they're in the bathroom. They're climbing up the walls. And actually, when you see that many, you need to find out if there's a nest somewhere nearby. And that nest is likely to be associated with wet wood. So it might be wood piled next to the house, especially if you're seeing activity on the really warm days. And then when it's really cold, you don't see them at all. Now, they could either be in a wood pile or a stump or something very close to the house, or you might have a nest in a wall. So say, for instance, if you had water getting into the wall void somehow, and it got some of the 2x4s wet and they started to rot, then that's where a carpenter ants will find it and they'll establish a nest. And they can be active when it's too cold outside, but it's warm enough because they're getting some of that heat that's coming from the inside of the house. So what you need to do is decide what you have. And if it's a pretty good sized nest, you can actually hear them crunching. You'd have to put your ear on the wall and listen very carefully and have a very quiet house. But you can actually hear activity if they have a well-established nest. So now carpenter ants are just one species. They're also pavement ants, which are the little golden ants that you see on sidewalks and stuff. There's also feral ants, which are probably half as big as the pavement ants. But the feral ants, you can always tell because usually you'll see a bunch of them and they're all in a line. That feral ant means pheromone, which means they put down a chemical trail. And say, for instance, they find some food, the scouts will put a chemical trail to that source of food, and then it's like a little highway going back and forth, carrying the food back to the ants. And it's almost impossible to keep them out of the house because the slightest crack they can come through. So usually you have to bait them. And different ants like different things. Like the carpenter ant will be attracted to sweet things and also greasy stuff. So that might not attract something else. Maybe they're not attracted to the greasy, but they'll be attracted to the sweet. And so you can mix up some sugar, three parts sugar, one part boric acid, and then make it into a liquid. Because ants like to feed on a liquid. They fill up and then they take it back to the nest. And that's where baits are really nice. If they take the bait in a liquid form back to the nest and feed it to the babies, guess what's going to happen? And if they feed it to the queen, that's bad news. So it'll take some time. And some insecticides are what we call contact insecticides, where you just spray a line and when the ant crosses it, they're killed by that exposure. But there are others like the baits that are poisons. They can eat it and take it back to the nest. It won't kill them right away. It's a slow killer. So that's what you're going to have to do is search around for the nest, find out what kind of ants you have. And if you're not sure, you can bottle up a sample of them, take them to your extension office, or that you can mail them to the diagnostic lab on campus and they'll identify it. If you have a microscope and you want to learn something, ants and all insects have three body parts, head, abdomen, and thorax. The thorax is the middle section. And the key thing that we look at for ants is the middle section, the thorax. And if you look under a microscope, you can see the little shapes and barbs and things on the thorax. And you can go online for ant identification and it will show you what it's supposed to look like. So it's not that difficult to identify them. They're fairly simple.
Sounds good.
It'd be nice to know. We had an invasion in our office this week, and they all came up from the wall there. I noticed them on the way back from the hallway, and they were all winged. So I think it was a mating flight because we didn't have food to attract them in the office.
Well, after the break, we'll talk about that.
So we'll be back, and hold on for segment 4.
Hi, folks. I'm Jelaine Fenner, your host of Strong Tower Radio's Gospel Melodies. Join me 10 p.m. Saturdays or 1 p.m. Sundays for some great uplifting gospel music. Only here on Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is proclaimed.
We're back for the last segment of Good Growing with the Garden Guy, April edition. Gary, What about starting your vegetables from seed? Is there still time to do it?
There is, but do you want to finish talking about Sue's aunt issue?
Okay, let's talk about Sue's aunt.
Yeah, I want to find out about that.
Well, when you have winged forms of ants, that means that the colony has gotten to the size that it's time to establish a new colony. So that's when they produce the winged forms. And they'll produce some queens and they'll fly off, they'll mate and they'll fly off to start new colonies. So you would treat them the same way. It just indicates that you have a big issue to deal with.
So it's, in other words, it's like the ant form of swarming for bees?
Yeah, essentially. Mm-hmm.
But does that work well with baiting for them?
Not all of them. Usually the ants that are producing wings are not going to be there long. They're going to mate and leave. It's the workers that remain behind that you want to get so you can kill that nest. You don't really care about the ones that are going somewhere else unless they establish a nest nearby. But
well,
they won't necessarily
do that.
Well,
it's not so great when they're all over the office.
No, but do you know how they're getting in? And
well, I don't know. They're somewhere. They came out like by the wall, an interior wall, not an outside wall.
Well, again, the first thing I would do is get some samples and have them identified because you want to know what type of ant they are. And by knowing what type of ant, they can pretty much tell you if they're nesting in a wall versus they're coming in from outside. But if you're getting a lot of them, it's more likely that there's a nest really nearby. But most pest control companies, they would put down something near the area where you're finding them so that they don't spread out so they'd be killed before they get there. But if it's a company that's looking for the nest, then they're going to try to drill a hole in the wall where they think the nest is, and then they'll spray a dry pesticide in there because you don't want to spray liquids inside a wall where there might be wires or junction boxes or things like that.
I see. Well, our landlord came in when we weren't there and he was spraying. We saw a few more today, but we're hoping that, and he's going to spray again, but we're hoping to discourage them.
Well, there are lots of non-rent-paying insects that will get into your house. I don't worry as much about one or two here and there, but when I'm constantly finding them everywhere, then I have to do something about it. I could give you a tour.
Certainly were a large swarm.
I could give you a tour of all the insects that will be found in a home. You'd be surprised what's in there.
Well, let's go to vegetable garden seeds and what is still available. Is there some things past the season?
Well, for instance, I started my begonias back in February.
Okay.
And the largest one is about the size of a pencil eraser. So something like a begonia, it's probably too late to start it. It just won't get large enough by the time you look at how long our growing season is. But many of the vegetables, you still have plenty of time.
So we have sweet peppers as a long germination.
Yeah, my sweet peppers, I started back in February, and they're now on their second leaf, which means the first leaves that come out of what are called the cotyledons or the seed leaves, then the first true leaves, and so now they're on their second leaf. So that was about the right timing for peppers if you want them a good size when you put them out in the garden. If you start them now, and if you have a greenhouse, you could still pull it off, but if you were doing it in the house, it's you're going to be putting out smaller peppers. It's prime time to start tomatoes and many of the other things. And one of the things, I don't know if I mentioned this last month or not, but I'm growing potatoes and I started some tomatoes early to do some grafting. And I'm also going to graft some watermelon onto either squash or pumpkins rootstocks. And the reason they do that is the squash and pumpkin rootstocks are more resistant to soil-borne diseases and they're quite vigorous compared to watermelons. And so that's being done more commercially. It's not widespread, but it's being done more, especially if you have certain soil diseases that you have to contend with. So I'm going to play around with that this year. And now, if you want, you can get, if you're starting your own onions for bulbing onions, and you don't want to plant the seed directly in the soil, you can start those in flats and then transplant them. But those should be started now too. And there are many different flower seeds you can start. Like my wife was asking about, well, when can I get my zinnia started? And I told her about around your birthday, which is late March. And we will seed those and move those right out to the greenhouse. So they'll have plenty of time to get the size that they need to grow. So we're right in prime time for starting seeds for a lot of different things. And if I grow sweet corn, I even start sweet corn as transplants. And
I think
I've mentioned that before, because I like to put them at the ideal spacing, which is 10 inches. And I'll just put them in little peat pots or plastic flats, and I'll transplant those. And those I will probably start probably early April, first week or two.
You know, there's
Can
one.
Can you stagger plant your corn, Gary, so that it doesn't ripen all in the same week and overwhelm you?
No, not really, because I only do one planting just for eating some, if we're going to grow corn at all, because we have a neighbor down the road that grows sweet corn. It's called Prey Farms, and they've got some of the best sweet corn I've ever tasted. So the thing about growing sweet corn in our neighborhood is you just have to fight critters, specifically raccoons. And they do too, but they have so much more corn than I would. Because the last time I planted it, they just wiped it out. So if I plant sweet corn this year, it'll be totally caged. So that's what I have to do.
It's interesting. I went online and looked at the germination period, and most of my vegetable seeds were 7 days, mm-hmm. to 9 days. And my broccoli has come up after about 4.
Sometimes that'll happen, especially if you have really good growing conditions. If your greenhouse is getting, say, in the 80s during the day, that's sufficient for them to pop out of the ground pretty quickly. And we've talked about in the past that you can get them to come up faster if you use bottom heat, mm-hmm. like a seed starting tray. But it's just ideal. The greenhouse is ideal during the day, because even on a partly sunny day, I've been measuring temperatures in the 70s, and on a really sunny day, it'll get up to 80 degrees in my greenhouse when the outside temperatures are in the mid-40s. So that's ideal for starting the seeds.
Actually, I have one tray of 72 cells, flat, and put it close to the wood stove. And so its average temperature is probably in the high 70s mm-hmm. or 80 degrees.
You have a wood stove in your greenhouse?
No, in the house.
Oh, in the house. Okay.
In the house. Yeah. Then the others, this is one of the things I call it a germinator. I have a cabinet of a freezer, and we take the flats, we figure out a way. We did 1972 cell flats in 4.5 hours, and we've got a system of how to do this. And
do you know how in a commercial greenhouse long that would take?
Tell me.
Probably like a minute or two. They have automation.
Sure, sure. But we were pretty proud of what we were doing, and so we put it in this old freezer and put light bulbs in it and temperature gauges and mm-hmm. try to hover around 85 degrees. And
see, that's why Tom and Brenda are very seedy.
Oh, please. But, you know, when I listen to people talking about starting their seeds and things, I literally get excited. And I'm a simple guy. I don't need to go on world cruises or those types of things. When I see a seed coming out of the soil and I think about I'm going to be having tacos and with fresh lettuce and tomato out of my garden, or we're going to make an apple pie from apples from our orchard, and that's all I need. It's just so much fun.
It's just amazing to look at that. 4 days with the broccoli and it's about 10% germination so far.
And mm-hmm. And when you have bottom heat or some way to keep the flats in the ideal temperature, that will get the seeds to germinate more quickly, and you'll get better germination, because the longer they're sitting in that soil, especially if the soil is kept wet, the greater the chances of some kind of disease getting them, or a fungal problem or whatever. And one of the things that I've taken note of is when I write down, I keep a record of what everything is when I start it, when they come up. And for instance, I had started an All-America selection. It was a cone flower. I talked about a yellow ombre or something like that. And the packet only had 11 seeds in there. And only 8 of them came up.
Hmm.
And this was with bottom heat. And to me, the cost of those individual seeds went up because they all didn't germinate. So I watched those things. And if I had gotten like 50%, I probably would have been calling the seed company and say, hey, I paid good money for these seeds. You owe me some more seeds. But anyway.
Well, good. So we do it in this freezer cabinet, and it's in the dark, but it has a little bit of light with the light bulb for heat. That's its purpose. Mm-hmm. Then we set up we have a wire rack, and we're going to put that by the window and start the whole process all over again.
Well, one of the things about those bulbs you have in there, they're regular light bulbs, right?
Yeah, incandescent.
Right. They put out what's called far red light.
Okay.
And certain things like far red light in order for the seeds to germinate. Lettuce is an example, that type of thing. So they need certain spectrums of light. And I think I mentioned this, but on some of my lights at home, you can flip a switch where you can just have the pink light or the blue light or the white light or all three or a combination. And what they'll tell you on the package is which lights need to be on for what. So for germination, you have a certain combination. For vegetative growth, certain combination. General growth, you'll have them all on. And what they try to do is mimic the spectrum of the sun. It's not as intense, but it does a really good job of producing starter plants for you so that you have good quality plants when you put them outside.
Sounds good. Any last comments as we're winding up the show for April?
Well, one thing, if you haven't done the maintenance on your equipment, like your lawnmower, getting the oil changed, making sure you have fresh blades on them, make sure you have transmission fluid, especially if you have rototillers. Those types of things need to be done. If you have rototillers, if the tines have gotten really sharp, it might be time to change the tines, and that takes a little bit of time to do that. If you're going to not do it yourself and you want to go to the local John Deere dealer or whatever the dealer is, you better get there real soon because everybody starts thinking about the same thing. And already the wait is probably a couple of weeks to get a lawnmower in or other small engines to get things done. So don't wait much longer.
Sounds good. Well, thank you again, Gary. Our listeners, from time to time, I have a chance to talk to them, and they talk about the garden show. So we sure appreciate this, what you're doing. And so until next time, we thank you. And listeners, stay tuned, and we'll be back next month. Bye now.